So the title of this course is Issues in ISKCON Reform, and very shortly you'll be handed out sort of a partial chronology of events. I save everything. I try to save everything, and so I went through my files, and I have lots of interesting stuff, but compiled a chronology. Well, this chronology of events deals with the specifically with the issue of the what scholars call issues of succession, crisis of succession, the position of the spiritual masters in ISKCON after Prabhupada's departure, and that became controversial almost immediately. And my chronology has just let you know different events that happened all along this line. And I ended with the GBC meeting of 1987. This chronology covers about 10 years. Since 1987, things have gone on. And maybe we'll get that far to some of the present day continuation of the same thing, because we're not through this yet. But I want to describe to you this time a wider historical context in which this took place, because I think my awareness of that helped me get through a lot of stuff right from the very beginning. I have to say that when I joined ISKCON, I had already spent a number of years studying in universities the history of religions and religious thought, and so I knew something about religions from a historical perspective, and I became a participant in ISKCON mostly to get out of history, actually. It turned out to be not so easy, at the same time, when I became an ISKCON devotee, that is, I really got involved personally with the movement in 1969, and just pass these out. This is the chronology I was telling you about. It should be what's two sides or two pages? Two sides of a page, yeah. And there are certainly things that are left out of that, but. And we probably won't even get to that today, but at least you'll have an idea of some of the things we're going to try to discuss. But don't read it now, otherwise we'll stop and go over it. when I joined the movement, I immediately saw something to me that was happening that was very interesting, is what I was seeing very close up, what was a religious movement changing cultures. The Lord Chaitanya's movement had grown up and was nourished up until very recently within India, and specifically within Bengal, and then for the first time it was moving out in a big way into a kind of worldwide international culture. And it reminded me very much of something that's still studied today, is the case of Christianity, which started out as a kind of spin-off Jewish sect, but right off the bat was incorporated into a wider culture. First of all, the Hellenistic culture, because at one time that whole area was governed by Greek kings, Greek-speaking kings, and the language of culture was Greek. I mean, the Gospels come to us in spoken Greek of that time. There's no surviving record of anything in Aramaic, the native language of Jesus. So everything was already, and right in the Gospels you can already see, people using the categories of Greek philosophical thought. In the beginning was the word, in arche heno logos. Logos is from Stoic philosophy. And so already it's moved into a different cultural milieu. And then further, it moves into the Roman Empire. I mean, it was already started in a colony of Rome, just like India was a long time a colony of England. And then somehow or other those colonial relations get reversed and things go the other way and the invader gets invaded. And eventually, of course, Christianity ends up really being the heir to the Roman Empire. I mean, it's the titles of Roman political administration become ecclesiastical titles, just like pontifex. Julius Caesar was pontifex, you know, before the Pope was. whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is still hotly debated, but that's what happened. So similarly, what we see with the Krishna consciousness movement is something that was in one culture and then moved into a kind of, I guess you could call it, I hate to use this term in this company, but an American empire. Let's call it a business empire, but a kind of a world culture in which, you know, Prabhupada could speak in English and expect to be understood in a huge number of places, and where certain forms of doing things maybe originated in America are now common all over the world. And so this is how Krishna consciousness was changing and adapting. So what you see happen is that this tradition, part of a Vedic culture, Indian tradition, becomes adapted. I can use some American words: retooled, retrofitted, redesigned, in order to function in new time, new places, and new circumstances. And then what, of course, we discovered is actually that Prabhupada didn't begin this process, but that it actually, at least people started to think about it with Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and then finally Prabhupada, these three acharyas are the kind of architects. So there's something that's going on for three or four generations of trying to make this effort. And involved in this transition, the issues that confront us now turned out to have been also dealt with by Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples specifically, and the Gaudiya Math. And really the person who concretely made the big change in how the Krishna consciousness movement would be organized, the real revolutionary, and the person who really has caused many of our problems today, is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Mm-hmm. I would like to point out two areas of this adaptation that are very difficult to make the transition is very difficult and which is taking several generations. One is the shift in the style of leadership. This is from Guru. As the traditional zonal, what we call the zonal acharya, is actually the traditional style, old-fashioned style of leadership, where not just in India but all over the world, and not just in spiritual matters but also in political matters, where you have a single, very powerful person. Whose personal power goes by the technical name of charisma. And by that charisma and power, an institution forms around that person. And that institution is regarded as the embodiment of that person. That's the standard style of leadership. That's what a king is. That's exactly what a king is. You can read in Shakespeare plays where the king of England is just called England. That, because that's what it meant. This person and the state are somehow or other the same in a way that we don't have anymore today. This is the mafia. The mafia style. It wasn't criminal. This is inherited from an old Roman style of management, and it's just pre-industrial, that's all. It's just an old-fashioned pre-industrial style of social organization. Somehow or other survived in Palermo and places like that. And I'll tell you something, just to show you how intuitively recognizable that style is. There was a period of time when Rameshwara was having his assistants either read the book or see the movie The Godfather so they could learn about management. Now, it wasn't because it was criminal, but it was the relationship of interchange between the leaders and the followers that was actually the essence of that style of management. So this guru, as the Dzogchen Lacharya, which that's how Prabhupada was also a manager like that. But he was trying to change something and set up a GBC. But we learned that Bhaktisiddhanta had wanted the same thing to happen, and it did not happen. Because the idea of this GBC is not exactly traditional. In fact, you find out, if you're an American, and the first time I heard this term, governing body commission, that had a distinctly British ring to it. I mean, we don't speak like that, governing body commission. That sounds so British to us, you know. And it is, because it turns out in India there was one. The British were very much appreciated for their management ability and skill to do things. And the epitome of that was this institution called the Indian Railways. And the name of the group that ran the Indian Railways was Governing Body Commission. That's where it comes from. And the first time in India that I walked into the GBC meeting room, I was immediately struck by the furniture, because I was thinking of a board of directors. You know, when a board of directors meets nowadays in America, there's usually a big table and everybody sits around it with swivel chairs, you know. One guy sits at the head of the table and everybody's on the sides, and that's how they all meet. Now they all have computers in front of them. But that's the style. When I walked into the GBC meeting room, instead of seeing an arrangement like that, I saw a big rectangular room, and all around it were these gigantic, overstuffed sofas and easy chairs where people sat around. And I thought, this is familiar, you know, where do I know this from? And then it's from reading the novels of Charles Dickens, who described in several places, as only Dickens could do it, with this sort of heightened, you know, parody, sensibility of board meetings. in London of various corporations, and that's exactly what these big overstuffed chairs, sunk into them these kind of board members, many of them with special kinds of footstools because they have gout, you know, they have to elevate their foot, and then running around are these little peons sort of carrying in drinks and messages and running back and forth. And I could see that the GBC was, this was distinctly the model. And only within, you know, the last few years do we now have a big table and swivel chairs. But that's, so I could see where this idea from the title and from even the style of the furniture, the cultural heritage of this idea of a governing body commission. It's something really modern. It's a corporation. And it was decided by Bhaktisiddhanta and Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I don't know any directly where Bhaktivinoda Thakur used this title, GBC. Maybe somebody knows, but certainly Bhaktisiddhanta used this term. That this is now be the style of leadership or management. And and as Prabhupada famously complains about the Gaudiya Mat, they didn't do it, that Bhaktisiddhanta ordered it, and they didn't do it, and instead they wanted to go back to the acharya, single acharya system, and according to Prabhupada, with disastrous results. So we're going to go through that. Because there were big problems and big turmoil at that time and involving almost some of the same issues and events that we have confronted. The other thing that Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur did as an acharya, someone who sets the style for many future generations and who was very clearly had in mind making something that would spread all over the world, that would be a worldwide preaching mission, was to change the kind of spiritual style of the Hare Krishna movement. The guru and the GBC and the style of leadership, in one sense you can say that's external, but then more internal. That when Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes how he was spent some time trying to discover Lord Chaitanya's movement in a pure form. He mentions in the beginning of a talk that Lord Chaitanya's movement at his time was quite corrupt. And so he finally found his associates in a group of bhajananandis, people who practiced Krishna consciousness but didn't preach it, who were babajis. There were no such things as sannyas at that time. They were all babajis. They chanted at least 64 rounds a day. They engaged in their major form of worship was not deities in a temple or anything like that, but Astakalya Lila Smarnam, meditating on Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes and deep meditation. It was, in essence, a religion of first-class devotees of Mahabhagavatas. What Bhaktisiddhanta did was turn it into a religion of Madhyama Adhikaris, or at least the style of the religion was a preaching religion. Mahabhagavatas don't preach because they see that everyone but me is a devotee. Who's there to preach to? So for preaching, at least we say you have to come down to the Madhyama platform. And that's what Bhaktisiddhanta did. So he made changes that are to this day controversial. And were controversial when he did them, and that's also part of the change that took place. So in one sense, we are dealing with these big changes on an institutional level. So that's one of the issues. This is issues in reform. So that's one set of issues. The issues of just retooling or retrofitting a tradition for a new time, place, and circumstances, and the people that we consider to be particularly empowered to do that. This is something an ordinary person can't do. But they get the title of acharya in the special sense of the term. The other issues that come down to in that process, at least in ISKCON and also in the Gaudiya Mutt, is how to deal with just a failure, with personal failure, with lack of ability to live up to spiritual standards, and how that gets mixed up in with this, all these changes at the same time. So that's another aspect of these things, gurus falling down, and similar such things. And then the third thing that I can isolate is just dealing with the smoke. Krishna says in this world, in any endeavor is covered with fault, just as a fire is covered by smoke. So anything that you do in this world is always going to have its defects or its downside, even if it's done by Krishna himself. Lord Chaitanya, you know, released confidential information into the world about Krishna's pastimes that were maybe not very well spread around so much. What was the result? A Sahajiya movement. And you can say, well, you know, look what Lord Chaitanya did. You know, this whole big Sahajiya movement is here. Shouldn't have done it. It was a big mistake. You know, but it has its downside. Things always have. You do one thing, and there's always going to be a problem. We say it's about somebody. Sometimes he has the defects of his virtues. So sometimes with a particular virtue, you know, somebody's very determined to get something done, and that determination is a virtue, but in some circumstances it can just be hard-headedness and inflexibility and so on. So that's the sort of things we're going to look for and cover in this history. And now, as far as doing history, there's a few difficulties about this. First of all, a lot of what I'm going to talk about, I participated in myself. So this means that while I can give you some first-hand accounts, on the other hand, maybe I'm not the best judge of things. It's going to reflect a particular point of view. Some things that I saw or did or that happened close to me are going to be more important than things that happened on the other side of the world, which actually in the long run may have been more important. So there's just a bias of perspective. And then there's my own particular view of matters. So this is not what people would call an objective history at all, because I'm in the middle of it. And you have to take that into account. It's not over. This is an ongoing process. We're still involved in this. And many of the people who are doing things are still around and doing things now. We had to be careful about what you say. Well, when I was in college, my father, who was a professional officer in the United States Army all his life, at least from the age of 18 on, had assignment in the Pentagon, the headquarters of the American Defense, in a large five-sided building opposite Washington D.C. across the Potomac. And when I was in college, sometimes I'd pick him up from work and things like that, and he'd talk to me. And he was serving in the Southeast Asia Operations Desk, running the early stages of the Vietnam War, I suppose. That's what he was doing. Anyway, one day he happened to mention me that he had had a hard day because some reporter was giving him and other people a really hard time, because the reporter was looking to see some documents that the Pentagon had on file. My father's superiors did not feel that they could declassify those documents, keep them, remove the secret classification. And so this reporter was very upset and irate. And my father, somehow or other, he mentioned that these documents were all dating from World War II. So I was shocked. I said, well, wait a minute, how can we have any, strategic secrets or state secrets from that long ago? The war's over. The Japanese gonna find something out. And he said to me, he says, no, he says, just that all our heroes will look like idiots. So with that warning in mind, I'm not gonna tell you certain things. I may leave certain names out. I don't think that if you were there, there was a lot of controversy and it was a difficult time. So some people did espouse positions that are now regarded as quite retrograde. A couple of things I'd like you to know about. I would like to dispel one myth that in ISKCON, everything was like Vaikuntha until 1977. It was, and you, as you'll, there were big, it was trouble from the beginning. I remember, one year I saw something I shouldn't have had, which was 3 years of letters to Srila Prabhupada. We all got the letters from, but you should have seen what his reading was like. Leaders falling down, fighting with each other, scandals, right? It was just terrible what was happening. And the relationships with among the devotees were they're much better now than they were in the early days. The only redeeming factor was that Prabhupada was there, but people were pretty hellish with each other. And it was hard being in the Hare Krishna movement. But there was the notion we had because our aim was pure and our goals were pure, that everything we did was automatically pure, which is a certain mistake, and you can't see your own faults very well when you have this attitude. So I do want to tell you, a lot of bad things about the Hare Krishna movement. I think as much as I am able to do so, because, but on the other hand, I don't want people to become cynics. I think what I see in human history is a tendency for people in the whole to spend a lot of time doing something really stupid. And then one day they discover that what we've been doing for the last 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 100 years has been really stupid. And they decide this was so stupid, so that what we must do now is just the opposite, which is, of course, is another stupid thing. And people manage to go from, this is the dialectic of history, go from stupidity to stupidity and go from one opposite to the other. So I think in our early history, there was a lot of what I would call foolish idealism. And the idealism was based on just being able to not see or deal with actual facts. And that's stupidity, the foolish idealist. But the other thing that I've seen people do is to go from being foolish idealists to foolish cynics. And to think there's, that no ideals are worthwhile, that everyone is a phony, that everybody has fallen, or whatever it may be, like that. And people can manage to go through both these stages without ever passing through actual wisdom. So I hope we can try to come to some point of actual wisdom in which we can really maintain our ideas, but know how to correctly apply them and deal with them in the face of actual facts. That's I think something that that we need to gain. But it's also another fact, the general fact about human beings is that you don't really become wise usually unless you suffer like hell. And so that's what we've been doing. And I don't mind suffering myself, so long as it's suffering to some purpose. It's meaningless suffering I can't stand. But so this is these are some of the issues in this particular talk today, this discussion these next 5 days. And let's go back to what happened with the attempt of the Gaudiya Math. Prabhupada was very critical about the fact that a great institution was lost because they did not follow the orders of the Acharya. That Bhaktisiddhanta said that government should be by a governing body commission. He did not appoint one person as the next Acharya, but disobeying his orders, some party without authorization selected one person as the Acharya. And then, so let me just tell you that then they took each other to court and sued and so on. If many people, it turns out, aren't so familiar with all of this, and I'm still in the process of learning a lot more. This is a hard thing to find out, also the facts about it, about this, because everybody you talk to tends to have been on one side or another, or have another particular point of view. But this involves with these certain changes that Bhaktisiddhanta made. And one of the changes that he made in making a preaching movement, as I mentioned, going from this style of Krishna consciousness, which is suitable for the practice of Babaji's and Bhajananandis, to a worldwide preaching movement. One thing that Bhaktisiddhanta did was discontinue the practice of Siddha Pranali Diksha. This is part of Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti. Now, this is it is not that Siddha Pranala. When I was a new devotee, I was told that Siddha Pranala is something that Sahajiyas do by some of my god brothers. But that's not really quite true. It is a bona fide part of our tradition, and it was practiced by Bhaktivinoda Thakur even. This means Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti mean, and particularly this particular phase of it means, the practice is that even though you have not become liberated, even though you are still have material desires, even though you have not completed anartha nirvritti, nevertheless, a spiritual master will disclose to you as a kind of diksha your spiritual identity in Krishna Leela. And this is what's meant by Siddha Pranali Diksha. And this involves telling the person, the sadhaka, 11 different items of their spiritual identity. You're a gopi. Your name is such and such. You're 12 years old. You live in the village, this village. You are the servant of so-and-so Manjari. And your service is this to Radha and Krishna. At a certain time every day, they go into a bower, a kunj, for amorous pastimes. But you go first and you make their bed, something like that. That's your service. And then you are supposed to meditate upon yourself as that person in that service. This is Leela Smaranam. Now, this practice was discontinued by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. His emphasis was not on smaranam, but on kirtanam, on chanting, and specifically on preaching. And it's also true that in our tradition, there is this alternative way of achieving also spontaneous devotional service, which doesn't involve this Lila Smaranam Diksha. It's not really there in the six Goswamis. It's something that arises slightly thereafter. But it is well known that it's not a required practice. Prabhupada describes the role of an acharya as somebody who, like a doctor who prescribes a medicine. And for a particular disease, there may be several different medical treatments available, and the doctor is the one with expertise to pick just the right one for just this patient in those circumstances. And so this is what Bhaktisiddhanta's decision was. And Prabhupada followed him very exactly along these lines. And Prabhupada, like for example, if you do a search in Folio, and you look up the term most confidential service and variations on that, which people outside of ISKCON almost always use to refer to Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes with the gopis. That's the most confidential service. You'll find that the only time Prabhupada uses it is in a couple of places commenting on Chaitanya Charitamrita. Otherwise, the very first time Prabhupada uses it in Bhagavatam, and almost always thereafter, the most confidential service and the highest service is to bring fallen souls back to Godhead. The preaching activity. And I'll have more to say about this maybe tomorrow night, but Prabhupada did famously say book distribution is in the mood of the gopis. And what he meant by that the mood of the gopis was always to bring others to Krishna for Krishna to enjoy. And when one is actually spreading Krishna consciousness, this is a form of gopi bhav. So anyway, this is without getting into the whole thing, this is what Bhaktisiddhanta did. It wasn't that he stopped at a certain point and said, you can't make any more advancement. He said, but this is the way to make advancement by the carrying out the preaching mission of Krishna consciousness. Well, almost immediately, Bhaktisiddhanta and his disciples began to hear, this is bogus, you're off, it's wrong. In fact, the first main person that people heard this from was Bhaktisiddhanta's own brother. Bhaktisiddhanta's given name was Bhimo Prasad, his brother was Lalit Prasad, who was still around in Prabhupada's time. And he and Bhaktisiddhanta had a big disagreement about this. Lalit Prasad just practiced in the same way that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had practiced, and he did not appreciate what Bhaktisiddhanta was doing. And he let Bhaktisiddhanta know, and Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples also knew this. So they did not get along about this matter. And it was a hassle. It also affected ISKCON devotees. Several of my godbrothers were actually reinitiated in the early 70s by Lalit Prasad on this basis that, you know, Prabhupada was following Bhaktisiddhanta who wasn't giving us the real thing. So they are reinitiated. I ran into those people earlier in my career in Mayapur. Somebody had been a devotee and he had this whole thing how he had to do this, you know, Astakalya Lila Smaranam and Siddha Pranali, and we weren't gonna go to Vaikunth, we weren't gonna go back to Godhead and Krishna Lila if we didn't have it and all this other stuff. And, Prabhupada actually, what he told us, that, at first, actually, he tried to have some dealing with Lalit Prasad because it looked like Lalit Prasad was gonna donate some land and property to ISKCON. But then it went sour, and Prabhupada told us that that Lalit Prasad was he was a very advanced devotee, but we shouldn't associate with him. And that we couldn't associate with him because he was critical of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. And he put those criticisms in writing. And it was on this particular matter. So there were these problems with the followers of Bhakti Siddhanta in the Gaudiya Math. They were always hearing this stuff. Bhakti Siddhanta didn't help things in that matter, I mean, because he was a very confrontational person. He referred to Lalit Prasad, I've heard, as my Sahajiya Bhai, my Sahajiya brother. So this is a kind of a family quarrel. And one respect, you should look at it that in a way, it's a transcendental disagreement. The definition is, the disagreement is how we should serve Krishna. One person says we should serve Krishna like this. Another person says we can serve Krishna like that. So between the two of them, anyway, it may have been a transcendental disagreement. When you get down on our level, it looks pretty heavy. You know, just like, in the Greek stories, you know, a couple of goddesses have a fight, and next thing you know, the Trojans and the Greeks are fighting, and, you know, but anyway. So on their level, it may have not been, ultimately, in the ultimate issue, it may not be such a big deal. It really may not be, but we have to deal with it on our level. It looks heavy. Then another thing that happened, Bhakti Siddhanta's disciples, sometimes they became affected by this constant criticism of Bhakti Siddhanta. They began to get nervous. Maybe we're not getting the real thing. Maybe, you know, we're off. Maybe Bhakti Siddhanta's too heavy, makes too many enemies. He was really a provocateur. Sundarananda Vijayavinod was one who wrote critical stuff, was Bhakti Siddhanta's disciple who turned against him and wrote critical stuff. And in one way, all this stuff really did come to a head after Bhakti Siddhanta's departure. What happened was, time, I think, in 81 or so, that some GBC members went and interviewed Sridhar Swami about Prabhupada's godbrother, about what happened in the Gaudiya Math. And so I heard that tape, and it kind of supplements Prabhupada's description of it. Prabhupada wasn't personally much involved at that time. Again, Prabhupada is the outsider. You know, he's the householder, and he's not very important. They complained about him, you know, later on when Prabhupada came back from America and the West with all these followers. And one of the complaints was he was never very important. And he wasn't, because the important people in the Gaudiya Math were all sannyasis and brahmacharis. And he was really, really an outsider person. Which can have its advantages sometimes, I guess. Prabhupada said they disobeyed Prabhupada's, Bhakti Siddhanta's order about forming a GBC. The way that Sridhar Swami says is that actually a GBC was formed. And he said something about there's supposed to have been 12 members and there was 13th, and we don't know where why that 13th got in. It means that what happened was there was a GBC and it began to meet, and I think the senior people, Sridhar Swami himself refused to be, although he was a senior person, he refused to be on the GBC because he said, I did not care for it. This is his own words. He said, I did not care for it. And sometimes someone else told me to use real strong language about it. Sridhar Swami was born and raised in a Brahminical family. In some ways, he was more very steeped in tradition. You could maybe see how he didn't like the idea of a GBC. I saw what happened when we had Gaur Govinda Maharaj on the GBC. And in a way, it was really kind of sad because Gaur Govinda Maharaj was a person who's also just steeped in tradition and was a member of the GBC and was trying to act in that way. But I could see that it was so difficult for him because here were all these people sitting around this boardroom and discussing and debating and raising hands and voting and arguing with each other. And he had a hard time. And sort of his expectation was that we discuss among ourselves and then we turn to him for the final decision. Why would we turn to him? Well, he was the oldest person. It's simple. He was senior. He was the senior, oldest person. We could discuss all we want. He would listen and then he would render his decision. And when it didn't work that way, he became quite distressed. And also the GBC, you know, a lot of Americans and the way people talk to each other is very casual and laid back and all this other kind of thing. It was very difficult for anybody maybe except another American, but it was really hard for him. So Sridhar Swami said we did not care for the GBC, and so we asked, meaning himself and some other senior people, and Prabhupada also says in one letter that Sridhar Swami was the architect of what happened next. They selected this devotee, Ananda Vasudev, to be the Acharya. And Sridhar Swami uses the term to sit in the seat of Bhakti Siddhanta. You see, the idea of the Acharya is there is the seat at the head of the institution. That's like a king's throne, your sovereign seat that nobody else sits on. So that's what he said, that they had selected him. And they said they selected him because he knew the Siddhanta better than anyone else. That was what Sridhar Swami said. He knew the Siddhanta better than any else. His position was, he was a brahmachari, by the way. He wasn't at that time a sannyas. He was Bhakti Siddhanta's secretary. So he had a lot of close personal association. And he was had a very good scholarly brain. I mean, later on, after he left, he took reinitiation among the Babaji's and became known as Puri Goswami. He put together a critical edition of the writings of the six Goswamis. I mean, gathered together all the existing manuscripts he could get his hands on and copies and came out with a soundest text. That's what he did. And it is the best edition around. Scholars today, they always try to use that one. They call it the Puri edition. That was Ananta Vasudev. So he was scholarly. Sridhar Swami mentioned that whenever Bhakti Siddhanta would mention a verse, either refer to it or say a word, he would always know the verse. One of those guys. He became the Acharya and also the person who initiated everybody. Then, now the rest of this, all this is Sridhar Swami's account. He said, then, after that, I don't know the amount of time, I imagine it was a few years, somebody discovered in his room letters from a woman. And that this Ananda Vasudev was carrying on a correspondence of some intimate nature with a woman. I don't know anything more than just that, you know how. And so the people who found these letters took them to Sridhar Swami and the other senior people and showed them the letters. Sridhar Swami conferred And they agreed among themselves that Ananda Vasudeva, because of these letters, he was not qualified to occupy the seat of Bhaktisiddhanta, and he would have to step down. So they approached him, and Ananda Vasudeva's reaction was, "You're all envious." He did not agree to step down. Instead, he condemned these people who were critical of him. And then there was a split. There were his loyal followers who apparently controlled most of the physical machinery of the Gaudiya Mutt, the people he had initiated and his supporters. And then there were the dissidents led by Sridhar Maharaj and others. And Sridhar Maharaj, he said it was very, very bad. He said there were bad names. I've heard other accounts where people mention fights, physical fights between the two parties. And Sridhar Swami, he also mentions that if you were on the outs with Ananda Vasudeva, you couldn't pass stool in a nice place, in other words, they wouldn't let you have access to the nice bathrooms, which means a lot in India. And also they only served you old rotten prasadam. So there was systematic and just lots of vilification. Then the next thing that happened, Sridhar Swami says, is that because he had committed so much Vaishnava aparad, this is his statement, because Ananda Vasudeva had committed so much Vaishnava aparad, he began to doubt Bhaktisiddhanta. So he was subjected to the same story, not only maybe Lalit Prasad, but also the Radhakund Babaji's. They didn't like also the way that Bhaktisiddhanta cast the parampara. They did not like to accept him as the disciple of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, who they regarded as one of their own, because he was obviously practicing in a different way. And there's a story around, which somebody's still repeating in Cologne, that actually Bhaktisiddhanta was never actually initiated by Gaurakishore Das Babaji, you know. We're all supposed to believe that he was a liar or something, but anyway, they didn't think he really was, you know, a true disciple of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, because he wasn't a Babaji. He was doing this other thing with Tridandi Sannyas. I mean, he's the one that started that stuff up again, you know. Wasn't around before him. They also didn't like, there also was another thing that he did was that he put down Bhaktivinod Thakur's guru as Jagannath Das Babaji, and his Diksha guru was actually Vipin Bihari. So there's also that sort of an issue. So anyway, he began to doubt Bhaktisiddhanta's bona fide. So he went and eventually, I don't know how soon this happened, he got, took Babaji initiation, became Puri Goswami, and did his scholarly work. Anyway, that's the thing that happened. By the way, it's interesting to note that in the 70s, the BBT Sanskrit department very much wanted to get their hands on the only decent scholarly edition of the writings of the six Goswamis, the Puri edition. And so they, in India, they traded somebody a set of Prabhupada's books for the Puri edition. Because, I mean, it's long out of print. Of course, you can't get any more. When Prabhupada found out about it, he was extremely upset and made them trade back again. He didn't want the books of Ananda Vasudeva in any temple. That's how strongly he felt about it. This is a bit of what happened in those days. Then after that, I don't know what, he married somebody later on, right? But I don't know if it was the same lady or a different lady. I know Yeah. Well, that's the story that we've heard anyway. There's a lot of stories from the Gaudiya Math, and I would like to get them all sort of verified. At least what I've told you so far. I know I also heard that he was murdered by his wife or something. But I don't know how much of the truth. But the story is, I guess from Prabhupada told us that he ran away with this, with a woman and, yeah, that's the story, that he stole looted some deity's jewels or something, huh? Yeah. Anyway, that was this issue of, then there's some evidence that the Gaudiya Math is staying in India all these years. Many of them, this is according to there's a devotee, Shuka Vakdas, Brian Marvin, who has done a doctoral dissertation on Bhaktivinoda Thakur. While he was in India doing research and finding out and talking to people who were followers of Lee Prasad and finding out something about this controversy, his discovery was that many people in the Gaudiya Math would secretly sneak off to some Babaji and quietly take Siddha Pranali Diksha from them, because they were, I guess, influenced by all this, you're not getting the real thing, you're not going to be part of Krishna Leela, you're merely go to Vaikuntha, something like that. So it seems to me that what's been happening is over the years the Gaudiya Math has been subjected to this continuous criticism from another part of the Gaudiya milieu about Bhakti Siddhanta's teachings. And we are also getting this is the particular philosophical problem I have with what Narayan Maharaj is doing. Again, that's the question of, do you have a guru who can give you Krishna? And do you have a guru who can really deliver you? And this has to do with this very same issue. Narayan Maharaj is now advocating and apparently practicing Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. And that was the difficulty that I have. And explain to people, the Prabhupada gave you A, B, C, D, and now here's E, F, and G, and I'm going to give you the rest. You didn't have time. And that's what I'm supposed to do, is bring you the rest of the way. But again, he did not get this practice from anywhere. He didn't get it from his initiating spiritual master, Bhakti Prajnan Keshav Maharaj, who was Prabhupada's sannyasi guru. Didn't get it from him. But rather, he went to a Babaji from Govardhan, who was his teacher in this matter. And the theology and practice I have testimony from comes from the books of one Radhakund Babaji named Anantadas Babaji. It's not that Narayan Maharaj has time to read all the works of Vishwanath Chakravarti and so on and explore these things, but all this stuff has been done by Radhakund Babaji, Anantadas Babaji, which is really the source of his teachings. People who were friendly toward him told me that he originally got into this because he's preaching in the Braj area, and there all around people are practicing Rag Marg, especially Raghunuga Bhakti, especially this is being purveyed by the followers of Nimbarka. They're big into this, and he got into this just to be able to compete, to offer something in exchange. This is whatever it's worth. That's what they said, how he originally got into Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. In my mind, at least, my big misgiving is that here there was a decision made by Bhaktisiddhanta about how the Krishna consciousness movement is going on. Prabhupada says his only virtue is that he very rigorously followed Bhaktisiddhanta, and that now Narayan Maharaj is kind of revisiting that decision and making it all over again. I disagree with that policy. But that's another thing. Anyway, that's still an issue today. The issue of, you know, the stature of the spiritual master being able to deliver the disciple, many people are in anxiety about their salvation. And many people think that it all depends upon having a guru of somehow sufficient and certified, I guess, certified advancement. One of the things that happened early in ISKCON was that, you know, this notion was the guru has to be a Mahabhagavata. He has to be an active resident of Vrindavan. Not only does he have to be a Mahabhagavata, but you have to know for certain that he's a Mahabhagavata in advance. He can't possibly fall down, and also you have to know that for sure. Seems to be the requirement that some people think has to be there. So, anyway, this issue was there from the very beginning. The Gaudiya Math then, of course, went into litigation with each other. After this Ananta Vasudev left, there was another interesting thing that happened. This is the decision of Bhaktisiddhanta was to have Kunja Babu as a manager, major manager in the Gaudiya Math. Bhaktisiddhanta needed to have a good manager for leading a preaching mission. Kunja Babu, who later became Tirtha Maharaj, who occupies the yoga pit, he's deceased now, and who later became also a very, very virulent critic of Srila Prabhupada and in writing. Anyway, Tirtha Maharaj was not a very spiritual person. He was a very good organizer and manager, but many of the other leaders in the Gaudiya Math thought he was materialistic. There's the story that once the senior sannyasis went to Bhaktisiddhanta and said to him, basically, it's him or us. And Bhaktisiddhanta said, you can go, but I need him. I can't do without a person with his managerial and organizational abilities, is what Bhaktisiddhanta did. But Tirtha was, the story that I've heard was that he had some sons who he put through law school so that later on when he knew things had inevitably come to litigation, he would have free lawyers. So he was, I think, he was the one who initiated the lawsuit business. There was that party, and there was the Bug Bazaar party, and they went to court over this matter. That's something else that Bhaktisiddhanta did, was sometimes he took people who maybe were of dubious spiritual qualification, engaged them in Krishna service, and knowing full well what they were like and what their problems were, but nevertheless wanting to use them for Krishna service. I think Prabhupada followed a similar policy, and that has its downside also. We'll have to talk about that. So maybe we have a few minutes for comments or questions. Yes? 5 minutes? 4 minutes? 4 minutes? Yes?
If you could maybe better explain this this question about that it's not necessary that guru can directly deliver Krishna to a disciple.
Oh, the guru has to be able to deliver Krishna to the disciple. The question is how the guru does it. Oh yeah, the guru has to be able to deliver Krishna. I don't want to say that, but not that. But what does a guru have to be able to do in order to do that? And from my judgment, from everything I see about Prabhupada, although there are many different statements, Prabhupada, when he was talking about practical application of ISKCON, he says the spiritual master has to be strictly following the orders of his spiritual master. That's what Prabhupada said. Yeah.
You said that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati discontinued this way of
Siddha
Pranali. So what was then his relationship with Bhaktivinoda Thakur in this regard, on this topic? They were also in disagreement, or they were doing this together?
I don't know the history of their relationship. You might find yourself in the middle. Who's going to tell you about the relationship? Bhaktisiddhanta thought they were perfectly in agreement. Lalit Prasad will tell you, oh yeah, he got on his case for this or that, you know. So I don't even know what would constitute information on this matter.
There were letters between Bhaktisiddhanta.
Yeah.
Bhaktisiddhanta, where he gave him instructions what to do.
Yeah, there are. I mean, it's not that he invented everything wholeheartedly, a whole cloth like that. Do you have those letters?
Yeah.
Okay, we have the letters too. Myself, you know, I never really doubted that, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta was acting under the orders of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Did you want to see, who do you have?
Yeah, it seems like there are other philosophical basis of differences between Diksha, Pranali, Siddha Pranali, and what Prabhupada envisioned, as far as I understand. It's like the idea that the guru at the time of Siddha Pranali, he gives you a relationship with Krishna, rather than that relationship actually being, you know, Krishna Prema,
At least that's the Sahajiya version, and the version of Radhakund Babaji's that Bhaktisiddhanta doesn't accept. But I think you can also have Siddha Pranali Diksha without believing that. But the Radhakund Babaji's and the Sahajiya's, if you ask the question, where does bhakti come from? Is it's not innate in the heart, and your rasa with Krishna isn't eternal, but the whole thing is given to you by the spiritual master with this Siddha Pranali Diksha. At least that's one understanding of it. Yeah, that's true.
I had one place that Prabhupada said that Siddha Pranali means chanting 16 hours, and also Gorakso Babaji. And once told somebody to approach, they said that chanting Hare Krishna mantra and mantra, practicing this process.
Yeah, I don't. I can show you. I don't have time to get into all the theological issues with this right now. But if anybody has any doubts, I can. You can look, for example, in Adi Lila chapter 7, when Lord Chaitanya explains how by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra he developed ecstasy. Prabhupada very clearly explains in the purport that all the potency, the only mantra you need, and the only diksha you need, all the potency you need to attain the highest realization of Krishna consciousness is given in the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Prabhupada says that quite clearly. Now, it's a question of whether people believe Prabhupada or not, but I believe him, and that's what he taught, and that's also what Bhaktisiddhanta taught. Yes?
Siddha Pranati, you have mentioned, is this not something that was at the times of Lord Chaitanya or Siddha Goswami? Is that mentioned?
Yeah, I think the word Siddha Pranali shows up, the realization of your form, but this practice of a diksha seems to have been a little bit later, but also a little bit later accepted also by the authorities in our tradition. But it quickly became taken over and quite perverted by the Sahajiyas.
in that connection, like...
I have to stop. We have, this man is stopping me. I'm muzzled. Okay. Thank you very much. We'll continue tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.